My name is Joseph DeRisa. I'm from UC San Francisco in the biochemistry and biophysics department. And I just started my lab there last July. So I'm an assistant professor there. And I'm going to hope to tell you today something about DNA microarrays and their application to biology. Specifically, I'm going to tell you about application to various aspects of yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae molecular biology, a model organism. And then in the latter half of the talk, I want to tell you about how we can apply some of the things we learned, some of the techniques and methods, to something of a basic human health interest, and that is the study of malaria. And so I think it'll be interesting. At least I hope it'll be interesting for you. And it's my goal during this talk is to give you a broad overview of DNA microarray technology and what it does for you, and then give you a couple very specific examples of work in my own lab and show you the problems that I face. And hopefully you'll have ideas. Okay, so first of all, this is a DNA microarray. In actuality, this is on a glass microscope slide, and this measures 18 millimeters by 18 millimeters. And what you're actually looking at here is the salt residue left over from the printing process of making a DNA microarray. Every spot on this array represents a gene from yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And when I say a gene, I mean that we PCR amplified, polymerase chain reaction amplified up every open reading frame of Saccharomyces cerevisiae from start codon to stop codon, that is the boundaries of the gene, and then printed it on this glass slide. So it's one spot per one gene. And it represents the whole open reading frame. So some are short and some are very long. They range from...
vacancies in the lower right-hand corner are imperfections in the printing process.
These vacancies are where we didn't print anything. And these are markers to show the corners.
What about in the middle of the lower right?
Some of these, like here and here and here, there are occasional blank wells or empty wells actually in the set of plates that we use. All this is done by liquid handling on a 96-well plate format. And so... we never manipulate one well at a time. If there's something empty, we leave it empty. It's not worth the time and energy to go back and sort of plug holes, as it were. The goal is to make this completely automated. That's the other thing. For the vast majority, probably over 95-96% of these genes, we have the whole gene. There's only a small fraction of genes that are beyond the range of PCR to amplify, a very small number of genes in yeast. That's not true for many other organisms. But in yeast, there's only a handful of genes that range over 9 kb. And 9 kb is about as far as we can go with PCR. Now, that being said, there's about 5% of these genes on this chip that failed PCR. Now, there's DNA there, but it's not the right DNA, and it's not what we want, or there's just primer left over, the residue of the PCR reaction. So it's about a 5% failure rate. And as with many things, we try to go back and fill in certain, or add another plate at the end to kind of help correct some of these errors, but some of them are just very difficult to PCR amplify because they're highly repetitive DNA, or the primers don't specifically amplify. We get multiple bands. There are many reasons for failure. So just keep that in mind. About 5% of these fail. So we have about 95% of the genome in total on this chip.
You know which 5%?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not random. It is not random. The longest ones are the ones that often fail, or the ones that have repetitive sequences, etc. And all this stuff is quality controlled, put on gels, examined for the right band in the right place, and it's all stored in a database. So when the results come off a microarray, which I'm going to show you in a little bit, that information is also relayed to you in a database. So if you're looking at a particular spot or gene, and it failed PCR, it had many bands in it, you know about it. There's a flag on the screen that tells you that.
And how many copies?
In this particular chip that I'm showing you, one gene, one spot. Now, what we usually do is make a lot of chips. So instead of just printing one, we print 200, 500 chips at a time. So we make copies of the same chip over and over again. But on each... Oh, excuse me. I'm so sorry. Well, Let's take a look at the next slide and I'll show you. This is what the DNA looks like on the spot. So this is an atomic force microscope picture, courtesy of Hewlett-Packard, which I gave them a same chip in the same series I just showed you, and they imaged one of the spots. And so you can see that the DNA is actually laying down in a monolayer on the glass in a tightly packed configuration.
It doesn't look like a monolayer.
So this is from here to here, and if you measure the height distance, is about the size of a double-stranded DNA helix. Now you can see some strands that lay on top, and these that lay on top are about half the height. Now if you look across a bunch of other pictures, in general it's a monolayer, and that agrees well with radioactivity experiments where we actually radio-labeled this stuff, printed it, and measured it. Since we know the specific activity, we can actually calculate how many molecules are on the slide, and that, you know, given a rough calculation back at the envelope sort of thing, it's about a monolayer. Now there's some piling up and stuff.
How long would this particular
cell? This isn't a clone, it's a PCR product. They're all from genomic DNA, so there's no clones here. And the PCR product in this case, I believe, was about, I'd have to go back and look, but I think it was like 1 kb or something like that.
Can you measure it?
Yeah, you could. Oh, I'm sure it doesn't look like this actually in solution. It's probably moving too. It's a dynamic thing. It's probably swelling and contracting. Who knows? This is dried out, desiccated on glass.
Is this a single strand?
No, we spot double-stranded PCR products.
So the fact that this is basically a monolayer is probably controlled by the concentration of DNA.
So actually it's not. So in radioactivity experiments, where we increasingly ramp up the concentration of DNA, there's a point at which it plateaus off and you get diminishing returns. And that's about a monolayer. So the attachment chemistry is what's important here. On this glass surface is a layer of polylysine. And so we basically have a non-covalent electrostatic interaction between the DNA and the surface. And if there's no more surface available, there's not going to be any more binding. And that's what's borne out in the reactivity. Well, it's probably pseudo-random. It's whatever's touching the polylysine surface. It's amine to phosphate backbone interaction. And we suppose, but do not know, that there's some, you know, certain number of interactions happening. It's unclear how many phosphates are attached per strand of DNA, etc.
Do you have an idea of how thick the layer is in solution? If multiple attachments of the column, it sticks out?
In solution, we don't know. We don't have any measurements in solution.
What is this about polylysine? What kind of bonding is it?
It's a charge. It's a charge binding. Amine to phosphate backbone. If you have a positive amine, it's non-covalent. It's essentially electrostatic.
The wells are physically disconnected from each other, so you don't have to worry about contamination.
Yeah, as you saw on the previous slide, the spots are separated.
Some of us want to know why you broke it into four pieces. Is that an
excellent question? So I'll show you in a minute. The four pieces here is a product of the fact that there were four printing tips used during the printing process. And 96 well plates, microtiter plates, is the industry standard for robotic automation and other things. And it turns out the spacing between this point and this point and this point and this point is 4.5 millimeters. Actually, this is 9 millimeters because this is a 96 well plate. We now print from 384 well plates, which is half that. So 96 well plate, so 9 millimeters center to center, 18 millimeters across. Now, currently, this is a very old slide. I made this array in 1996. Arrays that we print today are usually printed with anywhere from 16 to 48 pins at a time from higher density plates. And that just gives us throughput. It took me 52 hours to make 100 copies of this array back in 1996. And that same operation to make 225 arrays with the same number of spots and genes takes about on the order of 4 hours today. So things have improved.
And you'll tell us later why double-stranded DNA is going to be useful. I mean, you can separate.
So it turns out that when we do these experiments, we take these slides and we boil them right before we do the experiment. And what we're getting is these strands are popping open due to boiling, and then they're randomly attaching, or they're still attached, probably in both strands, but then bubbles open up, and then we plunge them directly from 100 degrees into ethanol, which basically fixes the solution, fixes the DNA where it's at. They're not going to re-anneal. Now, in solution, during hybridization, there's a chance they could re-anneal. But then again, because of the phosphate-amine backbone interaction with the pyrrolysine, they're not.
Were there other brands of arrays, other types of arrays that you exclusively single-stranded?
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you more about those. I guess I should back up a little bit. This technology, there are a couple different forms of this technology. This is the sort of garage form of the technology. My favorite, because I can do it in my garage. Basically, I'm printing these things manually. I built the robots, made the software, made all the solutions. I hand ground the printing tips in the machine shop on the lathe, the whole thing to make this array. And this is sort of a homegrown sort of thing. There are commercial versions of this array. The most prominent companies you may know is a company called Affymetrix. And what they do is actually they chemically synthesize each strand of DNA on the slide using photolithography masks to photo deprotect and then synthesize. But they're limited to lengths of only about 20 to 25 bases. After that, the chemical coupling efficiency of this synthesis fails to be robust, and you get diminishing returns. Now, they can do, because they're doing photolithography for making their masks, they can do much smaller features than I can. And theoretically, they could put on many, 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 many fold more elements. All right. It depends on the diameter of the spot. And it's a monolayer. And I can't remember how many nanomoles or picomoles are actually on a spot, but it's small. It's in the picomolar range. Yeah, but their coupling efficiency is secret, so you actually have no idea how much of that's a 20 mer or 25 mer. But we could go back. That's their dirty secret, is their coupling efficiency is horrendous. Well, we're never going to get through this talk. They're double strands, actually.
Sorry, double strands going basically just one line. It takes you much longer to use these
around. Actually, I should run some of the pictures, but we actually did AFM spots of genomic DNA spotted down, which is hundreds of kilobases long after it's naturally been sheared apart, and it looks more like a scrambled bowl of spaghetti or something. It's more twisted in turn. It's not so packed like this. And we've also done AFM imaging of the arrays on supercoiled plasmids that we printed, and they look like twisted rubber bands, as you would expect. We don't know anything about what it really looks like in solution. We have no idea. This actually is after boiling and after hybridization, actually. But it's dry. It's been dried out and desiccated. And actually, some of this material is hybridized DNA that has came in and hybridized to the chip. I can't tell you which or what strand, or we can only make guesses. If this is hybridized material, but I don't know that. I don't know that. But if you take a close look at the distances across some of these strands, they're right for double-stranded DNA. I imagine that there's just bubbles, sort of openings, and I don't really know. Then we'd never get any signal, right? And yet we do. So I don't put too much thought into it. Okay. So, let's just show you the, this is the machine. Now, since the days of grinding my own tips, which the last array really was printed with, these guys are actually EDM machined, electron discharge machining. And so these days, I have a machine shop in Arizona actually that just cuts these up for me with a lot more accuracy than I could ever do on a lathe. So this is the business end. These things are very simple. They're just steel pins with slots cut in the end. The slot is about a thousandth of an inch. And it serves as a capillary to take up DNA and print on glass in much the way a fountain tip pen works. It's all capillary action. It's all passive.
What's the spacing between the tips in this picture?
This is for a 384 well plate. So this is 4.5 millimeters from tip to tip.
Can you get a higher density by interdigitating it?
So there is another form of commercial plate that's 1,500 wells. But the problem with 1,500 wells plates is in terms of lab automation, is that the ability to pipette into them is difficult. It's hard. And a lot of liquid handling robots don't do it very well. And so we haven't gone to that high density yet. Practical matters. This is a typical round of printing. What usually happens is tips will dip into a 384 well plate, shown here, again 4.5 millimeters center to center, and just sit in the liquid at the bottom. There's about 5 microliters of DNA solution at the bottom of each well. And then, by capillary action, liquid is taken up into the tip, and then through successive rounds of just tapping on the glass, small drops of liquid are deposited on the surface. Now, polylysine is a hydrophobic surface, and so the spots don't spread, because that would be a problem, of course, if spots touched.
So the standard microscope slides that you've seen before?
They're standard microscope slides, 1x3 slides, the cheapest slide glass I can buy, except that we've coated them with polylysine. And that's just a matter of dipping into a liquid solution of lysine.
And the wells have already been etched in these microscope slides?
There are no wells.
No wells at all.
We're printing on a flat surface. That's the reason why we need a hydrophobic surface. So we have to prevent spots from spreading and touching each other.
Somebody put some detergent on the spot.
We're hosed. So and we learned all these lessons fairly early on. People did do PCR, and there is a couple PCR sort of protocols where people put detergents in their PCR, Triton X100 and things like this to enhance, well, they believe it'll enhance their PCR. And they weren't cleaned up properly or purified properly. And when you print them, they just make their way across the whole slide. It's a total disaster. So I brought a little movie, actually. This is an old machine, the old designs I built in graduate school. And I have a new machine. And I brought a little movie. And I'll show it to you here. This tip holder accommodates 48 tips, and there's only 16 in it here. This is a dry station. It's a vacuum, and it's just drying the tips off. And this over here is a sonicator, and this cleans the tips in between DNA loads. And what you're going to see is it's going to dry itself off here, and then it's going to pick up some DNA and then print it on this platter. It's a very short movie. But it hasn't been sped up at all. This is the actual speed of it, although the frames per second are, I think it's only 8 instead of a nice 12 or 14. It's moving up and down the dry station, picks up DNA. It gets rid of the excess DNA on the outside of the tip, and then prints. And we can print at a maximum of 5 slides per second on this machine. These are all linear servo stages, so they all run on magnets. There's no ball screws or rotary motors. And that, I'll just run it again just for fun. And so it's extremely fast, extremely high precision. It's plus or minus 1 micron repeatability, so we can put that spot down right where we need to.
Is it really bouncing?
It's really bouncing, but unfortunately the low frame rate of these digital camera movie makers is such that you only catch about every other bounce.
Basically, the reason for bouncing is they're trying to shake off the chemicals, or why?
But the initial bounce is, I'll show you this. So it's drying here. This bounces to dry the outside of the tip, too. It bounces here to get off the excess liquid. And then here's just tapping, tap, 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 tap. It has to raise up so it doesn't scrape the tips as it goes to the next slide. It only raises up about 300 microns off the slide when it moves to the next slide. So the platter has to really be flat. Now, this is a vacuum platter. This whole big black thing here is a giant vacuum chuck. And so it's all under pressure. There's actually a vacuum hose running right back here. And so all the slides are kept in place by vacuum. So they never move during the whole printing process because they can't. If they move 10 microns, we're hosed. So that's basically how it works. And so this machine with all the fancy magnetic stages and all that stuff, we built for about $27,000 total cost. So we're not talking big money here. And there's 225 slides that sit on this platter. And so we can produce about 225 copies of the yeast genome about every 5 hours. And so in terms of production, you know, we can produce a lot of slides really fast.
Yeah, so you're about the slides drying out?
They're dry almost, I mean, when a spot prints, that it's dry within a matter of seconds, if not. And so that's, in fact, dry is good. I'd rather them, the spots be dry when they're on the glass, since if there's any unnecessary motion or vibration, they won't move.
Eventually, when you're using these slides, you have to...
They're done in solution. That's right, the hybridization is actually done in solution. So they're hydrated later on.
And then when you hydrate them, are they hydrated droplets by droplets?
No. A solution is put over the whole array.
Why don't they mix?
So remember, they're stuck to the polylysine surface by this electrostatic interaction.
I see. Uh-huh.
They're not going anywhere.
So what about spot variability? Slide variability?
In terms of?
Well, for instance, how much DNA goes on a spot, when a spot came in, the first versus when a spot comes
in. So spot diameter from the first slide to the last slide is extremely tight. But there is variation, you know, on the order of 5 to 10% variation. Now, what does that mean for doing one experiment on one slide, slide one, and slide number 225? Not much, because again, we're doing competitive hybridizations with a ratiometric analysis. So we're looking at a ratio of two things on a spot instead of the absolute intensity at a spot. We'll get to that. That's coming up. So save that for more.
Can you now take the instruction again in the new place?
Yeah.
How much of the old do you
expect? None. Because there's this, you can see part of it here, and then on this slide here, this is a sonicator here. And so the tips go into the sonication, sonicator turns on. And it actually, in the new one, it also swishes back and forth really fast. And the sonication's going. And then it goes to the dry station. And the dry station is actually a little, it looks crude, but what it is actually there's these sealing cones. And the tip goes in and seals around these cones with the point sticking through the bottom. So the vacuum pulls right through the slot. So it dries the slot. And then it does it twice. Goes back to the sonicator and does it again and dries. So there's two rounds of clean and drying in between each load of DNA. And when we put fluorescent material in wells here, and then no fluorescent material, and then print checkerboard patterns, there's no carryover. And if we can't see it by fluorescence, we're certainly not going to see it by hybridization.
The sonicator is vibrating wire and working on liquid, or what is going on in the sonicator?
Sorry. This is a salt solution in the sonicator. And it's just producing ultrasonic waves. Cavitation is forming on the surface of the metal in the spot. And so it's imploding bubbles from the cavitation that distributes the force there to dislodge any particles or things that may be there.
And transducers are just sort of ferroelectric plates?
Yes. Yeah, I've actually never cracked open the sonicator, but that's what I imagine is in there. I don't take apart everything I own, but darn close. Okay, so that's how arrays, these variety of arrays are made. And I'm going to be showing you more about this in a minute. Now, these PCR products aren't the only thing you can print. I mentioned we printed genomic DNA. I mentioned we printed plasmids, clones, whatnot. We also print oligos. And so I'll show you that too in a bit. So if it's a nucleic acid, you can print it, bottom line. And also people are using the same machine, the same tips for printing proteins. That can be done too. So this is the sort of paradigm of these sort of classical microarray gene expression experiment for competitive hybridization. Typically, and I'll give you yeast as an example, yeast are grown under two different conditions. These are some experimental conditions. For example, the carbon source that they grow in. For example, glucose versus galactose, two different preferred carbon sources. The cells are then isolated, usually by centrifugation or filtration. And then the RNA, the mRNA from each sample is isolated, usually by a hot phenol method or some other chemical lysis. And then the RNA is reverse transcribed into cDNA in the presence of fluorescent nucleotides. Now, there are other labeling technologies. And actually, one I prefer today is one in which we incorporate a nucleotide analog that has an amine on it, an amino allele nucleotide, which we can then post-couple dye to it. And this eliminates any disparate preference of the enzyme for the two different dyes. So each sample is getting exactly the same nucleotide analog, and after we're done, we chemically couple the dye to the amino allele. And so it's equivalent for both. And that's nice because enzymes are finicky, and two different chemical structures will behave differently with any given enzyme. Okay, so two different fluorophores labeled here. We mix the cDNA sample and then hybridize it to the microarray. And after some amount of time of hybridization, for yeast it's about 5 hours, we rinse away the unbound material and read it with a scanning laser microscope. Mm-hmm. Aha. Good question. So before we do that, and I usually don't get this technical, but we block the remaining polylysine sites. So we use succinic anhydride, and that effectively will cap the amines and prevent what now we have as our probe from sticking to the polylysine, because that would be bad.
Right? It doesn't liberate the dependent material.
No, it doesn't.
How do you know?
Because it works, yeah. You know.
Okay, and when you're printing proteins, the idea there would be to print specific antibodies and then you'd have a proteomics chip?
There's both kinds, actually. There are people printing antibodies and then labeling up proteins and doing exactly the same kind of experiment. Pat Brown is doing this. And there's also the reverse of that, where you can actually print the protein.
And you would hybridize antibodies?
There's a couple different ways of doing it. You can either hybridize antibodies, or you can have fluorochrome derivatives of a small molecule that may interact with that protein. For example, an inhibitor of a protease. And you can see which inhibitor goes to which protease, that sort of thing. There's endless variations of these sort of themes. No. Single-strand synthesis. So it's as unbiased a sample as we can possibly get. Now, that being said, there are a lot of people out there who have no choice because they're dealing with infinitesimally small tumor samples, precious samples out of people that cannot be replicated, etc. They cannot be grown at will. And so they're left with very small amounts of RNA. And so there's a great deal of interest in these so-called linear amplification methods that use T7 or SP6 RNA polymerase to make linear runoffs. We haven't done that, and we don't have really a need to do that right now because we're not in a situation where we're limited by the source material. But it's of interest to the community because there's certain situations which you just don't have enough. Mm-hmm. So what we do is, right before we hybridize, we boil them too to eliminate any secondary structure, and then we immediately put it on the chip and put it at the hybridization temperature, which is usually around 63 degrees, 65 degrees Celsius. Some are a little higher, some are a little lower, depending on the chip. And yes, even at that temperature, some secondary structure will form on some cDNA. But again, it's a competitive hybridization between the two samples. And since it's the same cDNA template, basically, in both samples, because they came from the same organism, same genes, the rate at which they form the secondary structures and the manner in which that inhibits the hybridization will be equal for the two. It's always a competitive hybridization.
But the kinetics could still be dependent on how much time you allow it to.
Remember, the kinetics for both will be the same because they're treated identically through the whole thing. That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you say you have these bubbles of single-stranded bulges or whatever, do you have any idea?
That's my imagination.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't really know.
Is there any upper limit on the size? What I'm wondering, worried about is gene families.
Yeah.
A lot of things that should cross hybrid.
Yeah.
Okay.
That happens. Uh-huh. So gene families, what he's referring to is these genes which are incredibly homologous to each other. That is, they may share 99% of their sequence identity with each other, and there may be repeats of these genes. For PCR products, where you're amplifying the whole gene, if you have 99% of the gene matching the other gene, you effectively will not be able to distinguish between the two, given these conditions. And that's a reality. Now, that being said, as I said, you can print not just PCR products. So, and I'll show you in a minute, one of the things that we've been printing are oligos, long oligos, which we can target to regions of divergence between gene families. Okay, so this is the paradigm in which the experiments are done, and this is what the result really looks like. This is the raw data off the microarray scanner of the yeast 6,000 element array. And in this case, it's not PCR products. So here's the 70-mers, actually. We're printing long 70-mer oligonucleotides, which are, in fact, single-stranded. There are no bubbles because there's not going to be any double strands. And just like PCR products, these 70-mers stick like glue to the slide. So there's no problem there. And we can target every 70-mer to the most unique region of the gene possible. And we can also bias the 70-mer to the 3' end of the gene to enhance signal. And we can play other tricks too.
Do you make your own
70-mers? These 70-mers were made by a small Bay Area oligosynthesis company called Operon. But yes, we are making our own. We actually have capacity to do high throughput oligosynthesis for longmers. We have a 96-well oligosynthesizer, and we're running that sucker 24 hours a day.
Is there any duplication of spots? In other words, that you would have multiple knots for a single gene to look for variability and
uh-huh. Yeah, so on this particular chip, you know, Operon made these oligos. We're using what they gave us. And this particular chip is a unique one-spot, sort of one-oligo sort of thing. But there are a set of genes, 300 or so, for which there were three oligos for each gene, three separate oligos to see how the concordance between them. And then there was other printings of this chip where we just print the same gene 50 times and stuff like that.
And the scale of this very large print.
Yes. This quadrant right here is this quadrant right here. And again, this is 18 millimeters. We're using 16 tips in a 384 well format. So this is 4.5, 4.5, 4.5.
The way this is printed is, again, interdigitation of the...
Yeah, element. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What we're looking at is the raw tick files from the scanner?
Yep. Nope. Yeah, well, so brightness and contrast have been adjusted so you can see it. I mean, your eyes aren't 16-bit. And so, you know, dark looks, you know, a lot of the dark reds and stuff, you just can't see. So what I did is, and you can't, it would look like several bright spots in a field of basically dark. But it really is using the whole dynamic range. And so I jacked up the brightness and contrast so you can see. And it also would bring out any imperfections and dirt and things. And that's nice because you can see it's really clean.
Yeah.
I can... You know, it would be, if anybody interested in image analysis, I don't know who's really interested in image analysis or gene expression networks or whatever, but, you know, these images, what I can do, if you're interested in image analysis, other people ask me for images like this. I can provide the actual raw images on my FTP site. for people to play with if they're into image analysis. Some people, it's their bag. All right. So what I was going to tell you, what you're really looking at here, is the cohybridization of the red and green probes. And so where you see yellow, and I apologize to anyone who's colorblind, because there's a substantial fraction of males who are, but if in any case, yellow spots are the equal combination, roughly, of red and green. And green spots represent those genes for which the transcript was more abundant in the sample that was labeled green than in the red sample. Likewise, a red spot is a gene for which that transcript was more abundant in the sample that was labeled red compared to the sample that was labeled green. So it's a comparative hybridization the whole time. It's not the brightness of the spot that matters so much to us as the color of the spot.
The brightness is the artifact of the details of how many DNAs went down in that particular well.
Yeah, so in general, the brightness, there is a correlation between brightness and the actual number of transcripts, the total number in a sample, but it's subject to the variation of the DNA we print. If we don't print any DNA, there's going to be no brightness. And so just looking at an empty well here, you don't a priori know whether no DNA was printed or there's no signal.
No expression.
It's gone. It's just not there.
Which seems to cause problems in terms of statistical significance. In that, first of all, the significance, we have some idea of n, and that would be
so. Yes, in a sense. Now, there's a couple things you can do. Some people will hybridize. So you're not limited to actually two channels. There are some people doing three color hybridizations. And the third channel, some folks are putting a genomic DNA sample label that will light up every single spot. So you know there was DNA there. It's one thing you can do.
And this fiducial sample, absolutely essential in all these things? I mean, there's no way of... Could you do it without leaving out the red?
Is it looking very? I mean, you could, and like I said, there's a general correlation, but when we've looked at it closely, there's exceptions. There's a lot of exceptions, and there's a lot of things that can affect that. So, what can affect the overall intensity of the spot? The ATGC content of the gene. That's going to affect the probability that a given labeled nucleotide gets in. The poly A tail length and the ability of which reverse transcriptase can prime that message. That affects the brightness of a gene. The secondary structure of the RNA, that affects the brightness of the gene because RT can sometimes not get through certain secondary structures. Pause sites, natural transcriptional pause sites. RT falls off for whatever reason. There are certain genes that have these. And the quality of the RNA itself, so the overall quality.
Mm-hmm. Presumably, when you want to have a genome that's human at all, and you're able to think about 7 genomes, there is a set of, there is the best set of 7 genomes, the best,
the optimum set?
The optimum set.
Yeah. Non redundant, totally unique, no secondary structure. Yeah, yeah. So Operon has claimed to do this for yeast, and I pretty much believe them. I think they know what they're doing. But I'm going to show you later our efforts in malaria, where we did all the work, and I'll show you exactly what we did. Yes, it's a Gaussian curve of distributions, and some are pretty bright.
Well, most papers about expression analysis are about amounts and comparing amounts.
Right, which is why we do the ratio metric analysis.
The premise is that you cannot trust amounts.
No. Can't trust overall intensity. You can certainly trust the ratio.
No, I'm asking about the number, about its intensity. If you thought that you could do that experiment, and you would be very weirdly significant of your print apparatus, why not? You'd be able to extract good statistics on absolute intensity.
No, that's not right. I totally disagree for the reasons. I disagree for the reasons I mentioned just before. That is, certain transcripts will have natural different brightnesses depending on physical features of the transcript. ATGC content. If you have an incredibly GC-rich message, and I'm using T as my label nucleotide, the overall brightness compared to an AT-rich transcript is going to be diminished by maybe several fold, even though the actual numbers, moles of transcript is the same. So we never do single color hybridizations.
These samples are taken from these at a particular moment in the cell cycle, or how will we, or is there going to come off
something? Yeah, I was going to come to that. So what you're looking at here, this was meant to be an example. What you're actually looking at here is the comparison of two different so-called wild-type strains of yeast at supposedly the same point in their life cycle. They do change lifestyle, but that's another subject. So, and actually this is the difference between, so they're not two wild-type strains you would normally use in the lab. These are pretty divergent strains. And the illustration was to say that, you know, things that look under the microscope to your eyes to be identical in gene expression land are almost completely different.
If you take two of the same strains,
yes,
under the same spot, does the whole thing just light up yellow?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, done that experiment several times. Several times. Yeah. Mostly yellow. Yeah, if you did the same sample against each other, it'd be equal red and green the whole time. Okay.
What's the reproducibility of every 10 times for
the same? The reproducibility of the ratio of the ratio. It's quite good. It's quite good. What's the actual number? I mean, I don't have a good number for you right off the top of my head. But for the whole array, if we do the whole array, like these two samples again and again, and look across the entire array and calculate the correlation coefficient for the whole thing, it's like 0.95.
But how many times do you do this to calculate the
coefficient? The most we've ever done is probably like 10 times the same samples, 10 times over and over. Typically, people are usually doing... Okay, so I was going to get on to this. I'll just give my spiel right now. There's a couple ways you can do experiments. One of the ways is the following. You can grow your two samples of yeast and take, and you wish to compare them, and you just take some arbitrary time point in time, or what you think is a precise moment in time in their life cycle, and you compare them. So we used to do this a lot, and we did this several times. And what we noticed is, if you do the hybridization again with the same RNA, same result. No big surprise there. But the kicker was, if you have graduate students, who was me at the time, and grow up the strains again and try and reproduce the experiment from scratch and do it again, there was substantial variability. And that variability was biological. And it reflected the inability to actually precisely hit the moment in time twice of isolating two different samples of yeast. They're a dynamic system, they're growing. What was slightly different? Did the water have a little more chloride in it that day? Was it a different batch of media? Which autoclave was it made in? And on and on and on. And those are just the subtle things. There could be much larger things that I was 10 minutes late. Glucose was 2% lower. On and on and on. And so that was hard because you do the experiment twice, you get a different answer. Now, it's not that different, but it's different enough to make you concerned. And so we started changing the way we do experiments and started looking at things as a dynamic system. That is, there is no one point you can look at. You have to look at the whole system. And so we started doing lots of time courses where instead of just inoculating yeast, waiting, you know, till the next morning and taking the sample, we take samples all night and watch them through their whole life cycle. And so even if the samples were maladjusted, we would see the curves. And so this really helped things. And the way we do it is not just to compare the two samples against each other, although that's the way I've shown you the paradigm. Actually, what happens is we'll take RNA samples from all the time points, a small portion, and pool them into a common reference pool and use that as the reference RNA for one channel, and then hybridize all subsequent time points versus that one channel. And so that gives us the element of transitivity, which we now can compare array to array to array. And it also serves a very important purpose, right? So here, there's some stuff in here that's not so great. If you look at a very, very red spot, although, like, you know, the color, that's really hard with projectors and stuff like this, but it's the worst case scenario to be dividing by zero. This is going to give you a very inaccurate number. I mean, all you can say is big. And so with a reference RNA, you have some representation of any gene that will arise in that pool. And so when you're dividing, you always have something you're dividing against. Does that make sense? So it's an important subtle aspect of this. Oh yeah, that's exactly what we do. It's exactly what we do. You make a huge pool of RNA of all samples to which the experiment belongs to.
All samples.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so a lot of people doing human biology and cancer biology frequently do this. If they're looking at 60 cell lines, they combine RNA from all 60 cell lines. You can't. That's the point. That was the problem with the original experiments. Synchronicity is just a fuzzy thing in space. You can't do it. So basically, you just take points along the whole time. Are you talking about the synchronous self cycle? Oh, so that I thought you meant the synchronous between the two different strains of yeast. Synchronicity in the self cycle is another issue. And for a lot of experiments, such as this, we don't care. They're totally asynchronous. And it represents the whole cell cycle. We're looking for essentially non-cell cycle regulated genes that are responding.
But suppose you want to know which proteins are expressed with the time of cell division.
Oh, yes. Yes. And there's, yes. So for that, there are several ways to synchronize yeast. And this is sort of a yeast-specific thing. But one can use alpha factor, which is a pheromone, which arrests cells. And then you can then release them by washing out the pheromone. And they will release. There's another way to do it called...
You wash out the pheromone and then they all start at the same point?
Yep.
You're resetting the clock.
You reset the clock. Well, you stop the clock and they all get to the same point and then you restart the clock.
Well, I see the pheromone only kicks in when they reach a certain point in the cell cycle?
Yeah, that's right. There's a big patent on that.
I heard a talk by Gary Churchill where he was talking about various ways of sunlight and things like that. And if I remember correctly, he was sort of criticizing the idea of making this reference together in terms of the fact that you're throwing away a lot of the information that could be used to figure out the confounding statistical influences in the data.
Now, what's he throwing? What are we losing?
Just the, I'm not going to be able to reproduce his argument, but I think with something like that by doing this, what you're doing is you are basically throwing out information, you know, in terms of the fact that you are then having half as much, that you're only getting one set of numbers, specific numbers on each measurement. And I can't reproduce his argument. I'm just wondering if you're aware of it or why it's blamed.
I've never heard that argument, and I'm not sure what we'd be losing, but I'm open to suggestions.
I think
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that argument. So, let's move on. This is going to take forever. But, yeah. So whenever people want to take a break, let me know. But I'll keep going. Want to take a break now? So, where were we? Okay, so, I explained the difference between doing sort of single state experiments, you're only looking at one particular point in time and space, versus doing whole time courses of data to look how the system dynamically changes with time and with the environment. And that's the kind of thing we're doing now. And so, I want to skip to some of the big data, basically. What does this give you? This gives you a ton of data, getting measurements on all 6,000 genes in yeast, in humans, and other organisms, even bigger. And the question then turns to the biologists, how do I look at this data? What can I get out of it? What does the data tell me that's useful? What can I learn from this data, and how do I do it? Because the mechanics of dealing with mega amounts of data are not so simple to folks that are accustomed to using nothing more powerful than Excel, which is the truth. Most people are at the bench, right? They're not MATLAB programmers. And they'd rather just have something simple, and it's not clear. So this is a simplistic way of looking at data, but it's interesting. I'll have to explain it. First of all 6,000 yeast genes are here, going across the x-axis. The y-axis in this case, excuse me. So yes, so there are 6,000 genes across here, and the y-axis in this case are experiments. And what I've done here is pulled out 380 or so of kind of my favorite experiments. This is just a subset of experiments, but they're ones that I think show a lot of interesting things and I like. And so they go down this way. So it's been compressed pretty tight. So you're looking at, it's kind of, you won't see individual pixels there for each gene. There's about 380 and about 6,000 genes.
Each row is one of your chips.
Each row is a chip. That's absolutely correct. And each column is a gene. And so you're looking at the behavior of genes across many, many chips and many, many experiments.
Does the number of experiments include, like, one time series?
It depends. So, for example, there are things in the beginning up here that are cell cycle experiments, and there's 35 of those. There's other experiments for which there's 5 points. So it's a range. A lot of these experiments were done by a varied set of people. So the cell cycle experiment at the top was done by Paul Spielman back in my lab, Pat Brown's lab, David Botstein's lab. And some of the experiments were done by me, and some experiments were done by my other colleagues back then. And this is sort of a greatest hits. So it
supposed to illustrate reproducibility?
I'm getting there. Yeah. No, not at all. It's not. So, gray spots is no measurement available, missing data point. So, what are we really looking at here? Is a chart of the diversity of gene expression responses in yeast. It's a transcriptional map of the genome, basically, with many, many different conditions. So I pick these experiments to be maximally diverse. That is, I want to see what the range of possible transcriptional responses is to a wide variety of interactions and perturbations. This is a basic thing to do. It's sort of like reverse engineering. You know, you have a black box. You're going to reverse engineer someone else's microprocessor. You put in all the inputs you can and measure all the outputs and try and figure out what was in the box. That's right. So in every experiment, it's essentially different, actually. But most experiments, it is a time course in which you're looking at the expression versus a reference pool or against the initial time point.
This is the reference pool you described earlier.
Yes. But remember, these were done by different people on different days, different strains, and so they vary.
And is
they vary.
Clustering done?
Yeah, so I'm getting to that. So this is organized. And it's not randomly. If it was random, it would just look like static. It wouldn't look like this. And so what's been done here is that this has been clustered in only one dimension. That is, clustered in this dimension. So red stuff is with, I should say, red stuff is with red stuff, and green stuff is with green stuff on average, that sort of stuff. So what does clustering mean, and what am I talking about? You're going to hear a lot about clustering in subsequent days, so I understand. And so I'm going to give you the basic explanation, the sort of simple view of things, and the simple view and how far the simple view can take you. Two things have been done to this map. First of all, a self-organized map was formed. So Kohanan self-organized maps, you're probably familiar with. It's an unsupervised neural net algorithm for sort of putting like stuff with like stuff. And usually it's done on multi-dimensional space. This is only basically clustered or self-organized in one dimension across this axis. That's a little different. But that map is in the background. You don't see that map here. And then what was done was this was clustered by hierarchical clustering. Classic hierarchical clustering, the similarity metric is the Pearson correlation coefficient. And so essentially, the algorithm will find every column and compare it to every other column and try and put the columns together. The most similar column will be clustered next to the most similar column in the set, and so on. And it's iterative. So there's a large dendrogram that's hidden behind here that you can't see. It wouldn't even show up because there's 6,000 lines. It just looks like a blob. But basically, there's a large dendrogram that shows the relationship between all these columns. Now, what's the self-organized map for? Self-organized map is simply a way to guide the flipping of the nodes. Because if you cluster two things together and they're on terminal branches, a priori, there's no information about which should be on top. The red on top, the green on top, who knows? And there's a lot of ways to flip those nodes when you have a big dendrogram. So how do you do that? Basically, the self-organized map looks something like this, but not not exactly. And so the hierarchical clustering will then interrogate the self-organized map and ask which way to flip the node, based on where the row is in the self-organized map versus where it is here. And so it generally puts stuff together in a more intuitive way, more organized than it would be just if it was just a sort of arbitrarily flipped hierarchical cluster. It's purely for visual aesthetic use. That's it.
If you look at the genes across the top, where the green bands are, for example, that's presumably a cluster that all has something to do with cell division.
I'm getting there. Yeah, I'm getting there. So. Exactly. And now, so this is a very simple algorithm applied to this, and you can download all the source code and the software to do this. Mike Eisen, a postdoc in the lab, Pat Brown, David Botstein, when I was there, Mike Eisen and I were together in school. He actually put the software up on the web and wrote the algorithm for doing this, or implemented the algorithm, I should say. And data sets and the software is freely available, so you can go download some of this data and play with it and see what it does. And the source code's available too, so you can mess with it to your heart's content, and it's all done in C. So what does the clustering give you? This is a simple approach. I've done really nothing fancy to the data other than filter out bad spots that were flagged by the user at the time of quantitation, and those appear gray, or things with no signal intensity, because those are going to give bogus ratios. So I got rid of those two, and those appear gray here. So other than that, I've done nothing. And so this is the... Yeah, so it basically treats it as like one, no, as a ratio of one. So it's not a... There's a lot better ways to probably do it. And there's some other facets to this algorithm, too, that Mike Eisen's paper in PNAS details in more detail, but basically, after you find two genes that are most like each other, the average of those two is taken and put back into the pool as a pseudo gene. Okay, so what does this clustering algorithm give you? Let's examine the cluster in closer details. If we just point to some of these regions and ask what's there, the things draw to your eyes' attention, like this giant green blob. If we zoom in, and excuse me for the blocky text, this is the best PowerPoint could do for me. this whole green region is all about protein synthesis. So here are the genes in that region. And this is just a small slice that would fit on the screen in a readable form. This cluster is you know, several hundred large. But basically, every one of these genes is part of the ribosome. And the clustering algorithm has no a priori knowledge of the names of these genes or the descriptions. They're only clustered on the basis of gene expression response. And so the point being is that supramolecular complexes, like the ribosome, are co-transcriptionally regulated and thus clustered together. And so clustering information can reveal these large complexes. The ribosome is the most trivial of cases because it's by far one of the largest in the cell, highly transcriptionally co-regulated, and you get all the guys. They're all there.
Can you tell something about the nomenclature? I mean,
yeah, sorry. This is yeastology. So in the yeast genomic terms, all open reading frames have a systematic naming scheme. And they begin with Y for yeast. The second letter is the chromosome, A through P. There's 16 chromosomes. So A would be the first chromosome, P would be number 16. And then either an R or an L, depending on if it's on the left arm or the right arm of the centrum, of the chromosome,
oh, okay.
Divided by the centromere.
Okay, it's not left versus left.
No, that's right or left. And then the numbering outwards from the centromere.
Yeah.
So 001 is proximal to the centromere.
Okay.
001, so R001 is right proximal, and then L will be left.
And what is the diagram where the yellow
arrow is? It's small. I mean, we're just taking a tiny piece right here.
We,
hundreds. Yeah, if you can see it here.
They actually
cluster. That's a point taken right out. So that's the actual clustering.
Not some differently.
That's right. And it's phenomenal. If you can browse this even further, as you browse outwards from the green region, you will find after the ribosome, you get to translation initiation, translation elongation, tRNA synthetases, and other aspects of translational machinery. And for example, tRNA synthetases, very closely regulated with the ribosome, but not the ribosome. And they form a distinct cluster from the ribosome, although they're right there in that green mass of cells.
So we're
cells.
Turning to the
yeast
element.
So we, yes.
That element is left versus first. And then what's the second column in R?
So if they have a canonical, a gene name, that is, they've been named other than the systematic name, they're given, this is the name which the community has given them. It's not usually the community, it's the person whoever cloned it first or whatever they did.
And they have their own genes.
Yes, and in fact, this is as standard as it gets. Most of it's totally arbitrary.
Uh-huh.
Not totally. Usually it's some acronym for the mutation that the gene was originally found.
Okay, and then the minus A? Yeah.
So the Sequencing Project, in their infinite wisdom, numbered by one. They didn't number every five or something like that. And so when they had to insert one, they had to append like a dash A or dash B because there was no room. They didn't think like, oh, we should just number every five in case there's things we have to insert later. It's like basic programming, you know? Yes. Yes. Well, I'm getting there. We'll go over there. But yes, so you can also search the clustering space for anti-correlations as well as correlations. It's a very good point. But let's march through the cluster. I have a couple other points I'd like to show you. Okay, bottom line, simplistic view is that supramolecular complexes cluster together. So proteins that interact together to participate in a common function or process. And that's the hook of all this, a lot of this gene expression biology.
Some of them are quite close together in space, like 79W, 81W, and so forth. Is there a chance for these cluster things to be located in the same region or chromosome?
So it turns out that some genes in yeast can be divergently transcribed from the same promoter. So that's true. And there's Now, that is not an overwhelming predominant feature in the yeast genome, but there are a minority of genes that, in fact, do that.
Like E. coli?
Not polycistronic. That's like E. coli in bacteria. They're divergently transcribed. So one promoter can serve as the transcription enhancing site, and then transcription can start and go in two different directions. And they're independent messages, but they've been enhanced by the same element in the middle. Okay. So, let's take a look at another part of the clustergram, and this is part, well, that's sort of off to the edge of this and doesn't have an overwhelming feature that you can see really brightly, but, and there's three parts to this, and I'm pulling out three branches of a larger node, and these all have to do with the mating pathway in yeast. Now, I don't want to get into too much yeastology, but there is a whole single transduction pathway associated with mating in yeast. It involves secreting a pheromone, a receptor for that pheromone, the cell cycle block we talked about earlier, etc. And it's a classic kinase cascade signaling transduction pathway. And the point of this being is that a lot of the genes involved in this process are here, not every single one of them, but quite a good many, a lot of the all-star greatest hits to this process. And the point being that genes which participate in a signal transduction pathway or a cascade of that variety are also co-regulated, also land together on the map in the same place. So again, what you should also be thinking to yourself is that in among these genes, although you didn't really see it in the protein synthesis area, is that there are genes which have unknown function. We don't know what they do. No one's examined that particular gene. And so the question becomes, is this gene associated with mating pathway? Does it have something to do with this signal transduction cascade that hasn't been picked up by traditional mutational genetics? So it's sort of a guilt by association argument that if they cluster together, they'll probably participate in the same function or process. I'll talk more about that in a minute.
So what? What do you learn? Okay, so suppose I tell you this gene is associated with mating type.
Okay, let's wait till we get to this one. Because mating type, I'm not working on. So I don't really care. So what indeed? But, I care about this little red sliver over here. And I'll tell you exactly what we did. And it's the same situation. No, but that would be interesting. That's cool too, but unbranched metabolic pathways. So, you know, pathway like glycolysis, very simple thing. The enzymes are incredibly diverse. They have no sequence homology to each other, most of them. They do different chemical reactions, but they're in the same pathway of metabolites. And so we find again and again and again, even with the crudest of clustering, that you find unbranched metabolic pathways together and some branched pathways together. And you're right. It cuts off a little G there. Yeah. I'm gonna redo this with I'm gonna redo this with Flash, actually. So everything's done with vectors, and so it's resolution independent. But that's another day. And then we could dynamically zoom in on the cluster, actually, which would be kind of cool. Right. That's off topic. So, did I miss a cluster? Huh. So I guess I didn't copy the slide, but there's another cluster right in here in which you find all the elements of the proteasome and other, you know, large molecular complexes. The proteasome, again, has a number of subunits, 28 in yeast. There's 28 polypeptides, and you find them all in one place, totally co-regulated. Before last year or 2 years ago, anybody asked you what's the regulation of the proteasome? Oh, it all has to do with ubiquination. It's post-translationally regulated, etc. Yet, we find that the proteasome is indeed transcriptionally regulated, like every other gene in the genome, and these find smack in the same map. So, I'm sorry. The proteasome is a large multi-subunit complexes that degrades in a ubiquitin specific fashion proteins. So proteins will be targeted for destruction by appending ubiquitin to them. It's the garbage disposal of the cell. And it looks like one. So this little stripe here is all about meiosis in yeast. And meiosis, you know, being the process by which gametes are formed, it also involves sporulation in yeast. In the case of yeast, they make spores. So Yes. So example like we're looking at right here is upregulation versus a reference or pool. So this little stripe here is where we tested conditions that produce sporulation in yeast. That's why you only see it in this little stripe right here. So nitrogen starvation in yeast causes cells to undergo the process of sporulation. When they think they're starving, they check out. They know it's going to be a long winter. It's a program. And so we can start this program by starving them. And so that's why you don't really see this bright red stripe anywhere else in the map in such a cohesive fashion up and down. Now, there are other conditions in here which are related to starvation, but are not the total starvation that we did here. And so there are other things. What other conditions are you asking produce red here? So the things that are on this map besides the cell cycle are DNA damage, so elements that damage DNA, heat shock, of course, temperature variation, cold shock, of course, more temperature variation, nitrogen starvation, carbon starvation, stationary phase, that is letting yeast grow for a long, long time. The dioxic shift, which is the process of shifting from anaerobic fermentation to aerobic respiration, happens, you know, all the time in all this beer brewing. And various other carbon sources besides glucose, which is the canonical one. What else is on this map? Several mutants, mutations, overexpressions of certain transcription factors, individual genetic manipulations, hydrogen peroxide treatment, oxidative damage, and the list goes on and on. It's quite diverse, as I picked it to be diverse. That was the purpose. There's about 380 different arrays on here, and the number of arrays per experiment varies, anywhere from the high, you know, over 30, down to the low, which would be 2 or 3. Synapsis is when chromosomes get together. So I'll tell you, a lot of these genes have to do with recombination and chromosome pairing. And it's something I want to talk about in a minute in greater depth. But synapsis is where nodules of protein form on two chromatids. And synapsis is at the point which they believe recombination is actually taking place, that is strand exchange. And so there's this whole process of getting chromosomes together, holding them together, and finding their matches. And I'm actually going to speak at length about that in a minute if we can actually, if there's enough time. In the yeast world, these are the all-stars of the meiotic process, the early meiotic process involving recombination. And these genes were cloned by classic genetic manipulation and mutational analysis, that is, poison yeast, mutate them, see what doesn't sporulate. If it doesn't sporulate, you have a mutant, you can clone the gene, and then figure out what it does. And so there's many years of work here, a lot of these genes have been extremely well characterized. For example, SPO11, which I'm going to talk about in greater depth in a minute, this is the gene that actually makes the double-stranded break, the cut, during recombination, which allows for recombination to happen. And all the other genes involved in that process are here too. But again, same thing, unknown genes. And so now we come to the question of, so what? Well, why are they there? Were they missed because mutation was not done to saturation? It could be. And in fact, I don't think any geneticist who really knows what they're talking about would say that they've done saturation, that they've gone to saturation. because it's very hard to do saturation mutagenesis. And so, it's likely that genes were missed by traditional screens. And there haven't been a lot of sporulation screens since the initial ones. There's a postdoc in my lab, Jennifer Girton, and she took it upon herself. She's interested in recombination, interested in sporulation, interested in the proteins that do this process. She took it upon herself to take several of these genes, and there's more than just shows up on this slice, but she took about a dozen of these genes and knocked them out manually, just targeted them for disruption, and then sporulated them and asked the question, which genes prevent yeast from sporulating but do not prevent regular mitotic growth? Half of those prevented meiosis. So roughly 50% of the genes she knocked out had a phenotype and have not been picked up in the past. That's substantial. That was a little shocking, actually. And yet, she now has a host of very cool genes to take a look at, and she's doing all sorts of experiments to figure out where the errors are. And that gets back into traditional biology. So it's a simple sort of anecdote of how, you know, you can cluster something in a very simple way without even doing much hard work, and then look at what clusters together, look at the genes of interest, and then go after them. Now, why haven't they been gone after in the past? Because, you know, this data is published. I published this 2 years ago, actually, the sporulation time course, and all this information is there. There seems to be this phenomenon in biology that people do not want to follow up on a gene that has no homology to anything else. And a lot of these are pioneers. They have no homology. The blastids are really weak, if any, so there's no suggested function. People say, well, I'm not going to touch it. Could be, who knows? Who knows what I'm getting into? You know, you don't know if it's a kinase, you don't know if it's what, it has no domains, it's really hard to do anything with. And so people don't do it. But, you know, you knock them out and they're essential. And so now you can tag them, GFP label them, see where they go, see where they arrest, mutate them, the list goes on. Okay, that's the end of that spiel. It's a pet peeve of mine that people are afraid of genes without blast hits. So I want to show you what's beyond gene expression, what other things we're doing with these arrays before we get into the parasites. You can look at DNA copy number. It's easy to just hybridize two genomic DNA samples together. And this is a very convenient way to detect deletions or amplifications in genomes, so-called comparative genomic hybridization. This has been done in the cancer field by people like Joe Gray for some time, on a mega level, but now you can do it sort of on a gene-by-gene level instead of, you know, yak-sized pieces of DNA.
Again, why is it called copy number?
Copy number. So, for example, you could ask the question, or you could detect if a gene has been amplified as little as twofold. There's been one more copy of the gene. You could detect that by a ratio of twofold. That's right. We're not talking RNA.
Yeah, by what?
Yes. That's right. That's right. DNA copy number, DNA. Not RNA copy number. So the inherent information in the genome is mutable.
How often does this kind of situation come up?
Well, in cancer, it's extremely common, and that's why people are so interested in cancer. There are oftentimes yes, grossly amplified. And there could be losses of whole regions. So, for example, in melanoma, there's a deletion of a large segment of a chromosome that's associated with melanoma. I mean, it's not just a gene; it's a whole part of a chromosome, and that's frequent in many different kinds of cancers. So, you see not only deletions but amplifications as well, in addition to point mutations. But these are a little easier to detect on a large scale. In normal cells, it's not supposed to happen. Now, there could be amplifications and deletions which are not deleterious or do not have a phenotype. Could happen. And yeast do it too. And that's one of the bottom lines. There's a very interesting experiment. I'm not going to go over DNA copy number that much. What does it mean to sequence a genome?
If it's happening at some level in normal cells.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, who did they sequence? That's a valid question. And, you know, there's a project there's several other sequencing projects going on right now to sequence other isolates of the exact same species, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, on the knowing that they're going to be different. There's projects in labs to clone genes that are in one genome but not another, but they're the same species. Yeah, it's a great question. What does it mean to sequence the genome? It's a lot of money. So I'm not going to go over DNA copy number that much, but another thing you can do besides looking for polymorphisms that are sort of in the genome is you can monitor copy numbers happening in real time. What I'm talking about is replication. There's a project in my lab to do that, and I helped another postdoc back in David Botstein's lab, Arkady Kudursky, to do this in E. coli. Simply, you can arrest at the cell cycle, release, and then take time points and put this DNA on the chip, and you should be able to see the replicating DNA radiate out from the origins of replication, and in E. coli it's circular, and go around the circular chromosome. And you can take time points and time it, see how fast it goes, see where it hangs up, see if there's pause sites, etc. Now, that's in E. coli is essentially one origin of replication, or EC. In yeast, there are dozens, if not, you know, 50, 100, who knows the actual number, of origins of replication. And they're not easy to pick up by sequence analysis alone. And so therein lies the interesting question, where are all the origins of replication? The so-called arses. And in yeast, they're not all equal. Some fire early, some fire later, etc. Why is that? So that's a great question that we're asking just by hybridizing genomic DNA. And there's other labs doing this too. We're not the only ones. DNA protein interactions. That's something I'm going to talk about in more depth in a minute. But essentially, what you can do is you can isolate protein bound to DNA in vivo. That is, say there's a protein that interacts with a particular sequence of DNA. You can perfuse in formaldehyde and cross-link that DNA to the protein chemically. Then you can take an antibody and bring down that protein with the piece of DNA it's on and put it on the array. And you'll know where that protein was stuck on the DNA. That's a very powerful technique because this whole field of transcriptional regulation and where are transcription factors and where are they going, it's nice to know exactly where they are in the DNA. Is it a direct effect? Is it an indirect effect? What are the players at each promoter? Well, remember, we're going to bring only the protein down that binds our antibody. So we're going to only pluck out protein that binds our antibody. So there could be tons of other proteins stuck to that DNA. That's right. Mm-hmm. You mean if the protein randomly binds DNA as well?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's an issue. That's noise. So it's the enrichment at sites we're measuring, one could say. Okay, so DNA protein interactions. I'm going to actually give you specific examples in my lab what we're doing with that. So let's get to that in a minute. RNA protein interactions. There's a lot to do here too. It's exactly the same concept. There are proteins that bind RNA. You can cross-link, bring it down, put it on the chip. There's no difference, except that it's not genomic DNA, it's the RNA. And so there's all sorts of interesting things to do here. We recently published a paper in which myself and Pete Takazawa, a postdoc in the lab neighboring mine, we wanted to find out which RNAs were carried by these motor proteins in yeast that move RNAs from one cell to the next, mother cell to daughter cell. There was only one known cargo of the motors. What are the other cargos? Bring down the motors. We found new cargos. Now it initiated a whole new series of experiments. So I'm not going to talk about that other than just give you that example. I'm also not going to talk about polysomes, but it's a fantastically interesting aspect of this. What one can do, what are polysomes? What's a polysome? Polysome, in biology jargon, it's RNA associated with ribosomes. So which RNAs are actually being translated into protein? Just because you transcribe the RNA doesn't mean it's being made into protein necessarily. That's a key point. Polysomes give you that answer directly. And we use that extensively in yeast and in malaria and also humans. So what you can do is you can isolate polysomes by sucrose fractionation, that is running on density gradient. These polysomes will migrate to a specific density in a gradient. Fractionate that, take the RNA from those ribosomes, because our ribosomes will bind that RNA pretty tightly, and then put it on the chip. And so you will know, and you can actually isolate one ribosome on a message, two ribosomes on a message, three ribosomes on a message, and so on. You can actually tell which RNAs have one ribosome, which RNAs have two ribosomes, and so on. So you really know which things are being translated at high rates or at low rates. And this is important because translational regulation does happen. Now in yeast, it doesn't happen that much, frankly, because we've done these experiments. But it does happen for a specific subset of genes, and there are some genes that are transcribed but are not translated, except under very certain conditions. Yeah. What's that actual process?
You have a subset of RNAs or DNAs on the chip. What is the analysis that you subject afterwards on the chip?
No, it's exactly the same. Basically, we'll have, for example, polysome experiment, what we do is we take total RNA as the reference, all the RNA being made in the cell transcriptionally. We isolate messages bound to one ribosome, for example. We label that in the other color, and we co-hybridize the total RNA versus that. So we can see what subset of the total RNA is in the... That's right, these are fluorescently labeled and then put on the chip. Sorry if I didn't make myself clear. It's a bad jargon. Yeah, it's bad jargon. It's the product of living inside my lab too long. That's right, so we co-hybridize the total RNA with the fractionated RNA, fluorescently labeled to the chip. So, the whole purpose is to ask the question, what fraction of the messages are being regulated at translational level, and how much protein is actually being made? And then we don't have to do 2GGLs and all this other proteomic stuff, which is fine, but this is fast. And then genotyping. And I don't do any genotyping at all, but there's a lot of people who do. And if you're interested in human genetics, this is a really big market, one could say, because for mapping, positionally mapping human diseases, one would want to know where polymorphisms are in DNA. Okay, so now some specific examples. I'm going to give you two specific examples, time permitting. Meiosis and mitosis. Two fundamental properties of all eukaryotes. In meiosis, we're making the gametes again. Mitosis is simple cell division. And in my lab, we're interested in the concept of fidelity of chromosome distributions, how genetic material is actually passed on, and the structure and the mechanics and the architecture of this. This is one aspect. And so during, let's cover mitosis first, and then I'll cover meiosis. During mitosis, sister chromatids are paired together after replication, and they're lined up at the metaphase plate. And then during anaphase, they pull apart, and now you have cell division. So red dots are the proteins called cohesins, and cohesins is the molecular glue, the protein glue that holds these chromatids together under tension, because at this metaphase plate, these chromatids are under tension the whole time. And then there's a protein that comes in at anaphase, cutely named severin, and severs the cohesins and releases its tension, and the chromosomes pull apart. And if you've ever seen it under a microscope in real time, it's quite dramatic. I mean, it happens fast. And so they're at tension, they're kind of moving around, and then they pop apart. And so we're interested in this molecular glue, these cohesins. There's a lot of other labs that are too. And so one of the questions is, where are these cohesins? Is there specific sites where cohesins bind? Or is it sort of some random distribution across all the chromatids? Is it some random glue, or is it site-specific? And so we can do this experiment in a simple way. You can take cells, isolate the DNA protein complexes, that is, by immunoprecipitation. We have antibodies to the cohesins. And I should say we did this in collaboration with Doug Koshland's lab. Jennifer Gerton's the postdoc who, actually this article is not, doesn't go to the cohesins, but Jennifer Gerton is also doing the work on this, the postdoc I mentioned previously. Immunoprecipitate these DNA complexes, shear the DNA, right, to some appreciable size, because you don't want it too big, because it'll cover too much region. and then randomly prime and amplify and label the DNA. So from these amino precipitations, which you use with the antibodies, we get out a very small amount of DNA. This is not an efficient process. Even when we scale up to large amounts, we're not getting a ton of DNA down that we'd like to have. And so, unlike the RNA case, which we're doing single-strand synthesis, we do sort of randomly amplify this material. And we do it by PCR. So we put in random primers, let it go a couple cycles, and then put it on the chip. All right, so what do you get? First of all, you have to have a positive control. How does our data compare with data from the literature? That is, cohesin binding studies have been done before, but they've been done on very small ranges of DNA, although they've been done at very high resolution. So the data from Doug Koshin's paper is shown with these pink circles here, which they looked by quantitative PCR at these specific loci for cohesin binding. And then these gray bars are the red to green ratio off our array from the amino precipitation for the same region that Doug checked. Base pairs. Yep. Mm-hmm. Is Saccharomyces genome database, sorry. More yeast jargon. And so this gave us the confidence, looking at known controls, that what we're amino precipitating and putting on our chip is really the right thing. And we have other positive controls too. We know that cohesins preferentially bind centromeres. That was known. So we should see centromere binding. So here's a map of all 16 chromosomes in yeast going across the screen this way. And what I've mapped on here are those spots on the array for which we had a red signal of at least twofold or greater. And that's a fairly arbitrary threshold, but it served the purpose for this. And everything else has been colored gray. So these are where cohesins are bound on the chromosomes. And the stars are the centromeres. We know from prior studies that cohesins are at the centromeres. And sure enough, the hottest spot essentially on each chromosome is the centromere. That's great. But what's really exciting is the arm sites, where they are besides the centromere. And the question is, are these sites specific? Are they random, etc.? So the experiment was done again from scratch, growing the cells up, a whole different thing, isolated the DNA, put it on the chip. Jennifer did this twice in a row, did the chip, experiments correlated across the whole array, an R value of 0.98. It's almost identical. That is, if there's an arm site here, it's there again, even if you do the experiment again. So it's not random. Now, there is a distribution here, and we're looking at enrichment. It's not all or nothing. It's not binary. It's enrichment. And so now the question is, what makes this pattern? We've looked fairly unsuccessfully to this point at the sequences bound or supposedly bound by cohesins here by the red things, and we can't find a motif, any DNA consensus site that's identical in all these regions. And it's very hard to pick up a pattern, although we're not using the most sophisticated of tools. We have not been able to find a motif which these cohesins bind. Yet, there's experimental evidence to say that it is site-specific. That is, when Doug Koshin chopped out a region that was hot on a chromosome and moved it to somewhere else in the genome, the cohesin binding site followed it. When you take away the chromatin,
yeah,
you mean do in vitro reconstruction of this? I haven't done that. We haven't done that at all. This is all in vivo.
The consumer rate sort of pattern, make sure everyone uses this kind of pattern to separate, to make sure it's sort of the same kind of a chromosome pattern.
That's right. That's right. It's the cohesin. The purpose of the glue is to keep sisters together. You don't want them mispairing, and you don't want non-disjunctions to happen. You don't want one to peel off before the other one, or that sort of thing. Yeah, I don't have that information on a graph like that, but it's interesting. No. It's
where does their gene reside?
Oh darn! I don't have it memorized. It's somewhere in here. There's not one gene actually. It's a complex of genes, and they're essentially scattered throughout the genome. They're not all on the same chromosome. They're not polycystronic or anything like bacterial messages. I don't think there's a relationship between where they are and where the binding sites are. It would be fun to look at. What relationships are there? Well, if you plot the number of the binding sites versus the length of the chromosome, it turns out it's pretty darn linear. That is, there seems to be a fairly linear relationship between the number of sites and the length of the chromosome. And that's interesting, because it seems like you're just putting as many cohesins as you have space for, essentially. But that is sort of contradictory to the experiments where you can move a binding site from spot to spot. So either it's evolutionarily been selected for to be just like this, that is, some stable number per unit length, or there's something else going on we don't know about. Now, one of the things we're doing to investigate this is we're going to do a, I'm going to back up, we're going to do a time course, actually, just like all our other stuff, except it's not RNA, it's not expression. We're going to watch these cohesins form on the chromatids. That is, we can arrest the cell cycle and then let it proceed and take time points and see which sites are preferred. Are there some preferred sites? Are there nucleation sites and some sort of polymerization happening? We don't know. There's a lot of other people working on it. And my feeling is that loading of the cohesins at the centromere is independent of the arm sites. And there's some data in the literature to support this. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah, they caught my eye too. A cryptic centromere. Pseudo-centromere. Sequence analysis of that region does reveal some SEN-like sequences that are sort of similar, but there's really not a lot of genetic data to support a centromere there. So sort of skeptical that it's a real cryptic centromere. But, I mean, that is, that it ever performs as a centromere. But could it provide a cryptic site for loading of cohesins? That's a good question, and something we'd like to look at. You bet. Well, actually, it's not really a round thing. So these are condensed chromosomes, so they're looped and packed. And the question is, well, where are the cohesins relative to these loops? And do the cohesins form the boundaries of the loops? That's one of the current theories in this field, is that they do form those loop boundaries, as it were. And that's one thing we'd like to take a look at, too. And it should be doable. Now, one of the other experiments that we're doing right now is actually we found... Yes, so we tried that, too, to see if there was periodicity to it. See if we could, you know, fit some periodicity to this. And we really had a hard time. And that's not to say we can't do, you know, it can't be done. It might be just our own inability to get it done. Yeah, it's about 1 every 15 kb, basically. Yeah. That's right. That's definitely, there's some regions that really look periodic, you know. Here. It would be interesting to see. A site. Oh, you mean, okay, so let me define what's actually on this chip. Again, this is the yeast orphorae. We have every open reading frame of yeast. And so, but not only that, we also amplified every in-between region of yeast. So every single base pair of yeast is technically represented on this chip. We amplified every gene and every in-between gene, which is why it's a continuous bar. Now, there's some holes where we just, you know, haven't amplified that region. But we have almost continuous representation. But the resolution is limited by the feature size. So when I say a site, a cohesin binding site, I'm talking about the feature that lights up. If it's twofold enriched, yes. The red segment is one. It's a spot. One red segment on this chart is a single DNA. That's right, because the PCR product's the size of the feature. Some features are 50 base pairs. Some features are 9 kb. The spot is the size of the feature. So when I say a resolution is limited by feature size, that's what I mean. Right, right. So in many of these cases, especially around the centromere, we have, you have, you know, dozens of genes all coming down with the protein, which is nice. It's nice because, you know, they have nothing to do with each other in terms of cross-hybridization or anything like that, yet they come down with the protein. So it's kind of a reassuring that that actually happens that way. Okay, so I want to show you one more example. I really want to get to malaria stuff, so I'm going to try and go. Meiosis in yeast. I mentioned the SPO11 protein that makes the double-stranded breaks. Well, recombination is, you know, it's a very interesting, intricate process, even in yeast. And a lot of these things are directly related to humans. SPO11 in yeast has a very strong blast hit. In humans, it's also SPO11. That is the protein that does the same function. And recombination is important for a whole bunch of different things that I'm not going to belabor because I really want to get to the data. But basically, the bottom line is recombination rates really vary, and that there are some hot spots in DNA and there's some cold spots. Hot spots being those areas which recombination happens much more frequently than otherwise would be predicted if it was totally random. Cold spots are the opposite of that. And so our question was, where are the hot spots and where are the cold spots? We can do that because SPO11 binds DNA. And we can take SPO11 and immunoprecipitate it and find all the hot spots and all the cold spots simultaneously. SPO11, again, it's related to a type 2 topoisomerase. And we have a special mutation in yeast called RAD50S, more yeastology, where SPO11 will remain covalently attached to its double-stranded break. That's key, because we don't have to cross-link. We don't have to put in formaldehyde or do anything tricky like that. SPO11 does the work for us. And then we just need to immunoprecipitate it, make an antibody to it, and bring it down with its DNA. And then we put it, label it fluorescently, hybridize it to the chip. So again, exact same paradigm. These are called chromatin IPs in the business, or chip on chips. Here's an exact similar map. This map was not done. This map here is not done with the intergenic array, that is the one that has intergenic regions. But this is now a recombination map. So what you're looking at here, red, are regions of enhanced recombination, of greater than expected frequency of recombination. And green are regions of much lower than expected recombination. And gray is sort of the in-between state of those two. Now, again, where's the positive control? How do we know we're not just looking at some artifact or something? If we just zoom in right there, this is the known hotspot in this strain of yeast. It's a gene called HIS4. It's the brightest red one in the center right there. And that had been well characterized before. It was the kind of canonically known hotspot. And so we expected to see that in our assay. And in many, many replicates of this, we always get that hotspot. Our positive control always checks out. And in fact, these hotspots, like the cohesin binding sites, are incredibly stable. Do the experiment again from scratch, same hotspots. And subsequently, these have been individually verified by Southern blotting, a time-consuming, laborious, and ugly process. I don't recommend to anybody. But they check out. Now, we only verified about a dozen of these. And this is published in PNAS by Jennifer Girton. It's a postdoc in my lab right now. And it's very interesting because, like the cohesins, they seem to be site-specific. But like the cohesins, I can't find a motif. I can't figure out what is making it happen. And other people haven't figured it out yet. And so it's got to be encoded in the DNA. At some level, this is encoded in some cis-acting elements in the DNA. What is the complexity of that motif, and how do you figure it out? I don't know. And we're not really sure. And no one's done it yet. But it would be great to figure out how that works. Now, there's some descriptive information we can come up with that shows some general correlations. Back up one. One of the general correlations is that hotspots seem to correlate with regions of above average GC content in the genome. Fairly easy thing to look at. But For 162 of 177 of the hotspots, they have an above average GC content if you use a 5 kb window. So, and you can see this is a graph of chromosome 3, I believe, and here's the centromere here, and this is their signal from our array, from the SPO11 array, and this is the percent GC up here. And you can see a general correlation, but the correlation, I mean, the GC content is not predictive. So if I pull out a high GC region, and I say this predicts where a hotspot's going to be, doesn't hold. You can't use it predictively. More mysteries, more problems. But that's why we're getting you involved.
What is
centromere? Centromere? Yeah, no problem. Okay. So yeast don't really have CpG islands like the human genome does. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, so that's also correlated with GC content. Yeah. So I haven't done the sort of classical CpG analysis that you would see for human transcript mapping, but I imagine it's very similar.
Maybe we better let you tell about malaria.
I know. 15 minutes. Well, I gotta call the shuttle and hope they show up on time. Really? Problem solved. Cool. We got to pick up my bag at that Best Western. Pretty close. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. That takes the load off. I would have been hosed. So what can we learn? What can we learn? I mean, can we use what we've learned in yeast and apply it to malaria? This is not supposed to be the comedy part of it. This is supposed to be serious. What is malaria? So it's an infectious disease spread by the Anopheles mosquito. You may or may not know the statistics, but it is a pretty serious disease. We're talking about, you know, anywhere from about 1.5 to over 2.5 million deaths per year due to malaria alone. That's a lot of people. Put all your colon cancers and all your breast cancers and all that stuff together, you'll never match malaria, death per death. Hmm? 1.5 million on average. Yeah. Clinical cases is 300 million. These are people who get sick, but they live. Now, most of the people dying are kids. So these are like 95% children under 5 don't make it. Exposure to the world population is about 2 billion people. So it's a fairly serious disease. And yet, United States, no one's dying of it. Probably 700 cases of malaria per year here. And they almost always come in on an airplane. So it's not a serious issue in the United States. And the people who are dying of this disease certainly aren't carrying credit cards. And so they're not on the high radar screen profile of the large pharmaceutical companies. Viagra is a much more lucrative drug than any anti-malarial. And so there's a good reason to study malaria. That's the bottom line, because other people aren't. And we think we can bring in some of the tools that we've developed in yeast and sort of make some sense of malaria, which has traditionally been not a, you know, high point in science. There's a lot of great work being done in malaria, but there's not a lot of people. There's only a couple labs in California alone, period, that study malaria. Whereas there's hundreds that study yeast. Okay. It also has an extremely baroque lifestyle.
Why would credit cards care about yeast?
Model organism? It's on the Security Council of Organisms. Drosophila, yeast, C. elegans. Malaria certainly isn't. And yeast is easy to work on. The tools are all there. Why is malaria such a pain in the butt? Widespread drug resistance. So the drugs that were developed during the 60s, and then before that, in World War II, chloroquine, mefloquine, etc., there are strains of malaria that are resistant to them all. And so you just can't treat some of these strains anymore. Widespread drug resistance. And mainly, this was due to misuse. Anecdotally, there's the WHO, World Health Organization, doped table salt with chloroquine in Brazil. At least they advocated it. I'm not sure who exactly did it. But everybody's getting a subclinical dose of chloroquine, you can imagine that over a period of years of this in the 60s, you're just going to select for resistant strains. And in fact, Brazil is one of the first places in which chloroquine resistance arose.
That's a misguided policy.
That's a bad policy. There's a great book called The Malaria Capers. You can get it off Amazon.com that sort of illustrates some of the disastrous attempts at malaria abatement in the world. It's very interesting. But anyway, there are very few verified drug targets, only a handful, where there are dozens and dozens in the human genome and in bacterial systems. There are very few drugs in the pipeline. There's about 2 to 3 drugs registered every single year for antimicrobial use. For malaria, it's about 1 a decade gets registered that is a real available drug. That's a poor record of development. There's no vaccine with an operational impact, and I don't think there's going to be. One of the fundamental properties of malaria is that there's no natural immunity. If you get sick, you can get sick again, and again, and again, and again. And you're not going to be resistant, no matter how many times you get infected. And that does not bode well for vaccine development. I recently heard Dan Carucci, U.S. commander of the U.S. Naval Corps, who does a lot, U.S. Naval Medical Corps, does a lot of malaria research, speak of a vaccine trial where they use irradiated sporozoites. Excuse me, that's using more malaria jargon there, but irradiated mosquitoes harboring the parasite and then have it bite the person to be vaccinated. And it did not protect very well, is the bottom line. And yet, you have to go through this regimen of getting bitten every day for 6 months. And that didn't help much. So, vaccine development, I'm not confident is going to be a major area of progress. And it's a third world disease that I spoke about before. So why is it so darn difficult? It's poor genetics is one reason. You can't do the sort of crosses and matings you could do in yeast. There have been some malaria crosses. They take 3 to 5 years to do, and a lot of chimpanzees. The average researcher cannot do this, nor would want to do it in some cases. Poor transfection efficiency, that is getting genes into the organism. It's about 1 in 1,000,000, which is pretty bad, which means, and is the reason for, the fact that no gene has ever been cloned in malaria by complementation, classic genetic complementation. Doesn't happen because you can't get in enough genes. So that's very difficult. Very difficult to express the proteins in other systems. If I take a malaria gene, put it in yeast and try and make protein, doesn't work very well. And there's a lot of reasons for why this may be. And one of those reasons is it has a very high AT content. The genome is on average about 82% AT. That's huge. Yeast is considered AT rich, and it's 60%. In intergenic regions, the AT content goes as high as 92%, which is ridiculous. The intergenic regions are all A's and T's. It's amazing. It's a very strange genome content.
And then why does that make it difficult for us?
The translational machinery, transcriptional machinery in these other organisms are not adapted to this GC content, and it causes problems. Cryptic adenylation sites, polyadenylation sites, etc. Yeah, Dicti, yeah, right. Yeah, I think there has been work there, yeah. And there's another organism, too, that also has similar AT content. People are exploring. And you have to use human blood to culture it. You can't use cow blood. You can use chimpanzee blood, but of course that would be far more expensive than actually using human blood. And it's probably not that good either. Human blood's the best. And as you know, in California, there's a blood shortage. Chronically a blood shortage. There's not enough donors, so I can't go out and just buy blood. You just can't do it. You could pay volunteers, and they're not volunteers at that point. You could pay people to actually give blood, but that gets expensive too. So in my lab, we have a rotating donation schedule, and we grow all the malaria in our own blood. And there's no other choice. And so there's not a lot of incentive to do this in other labs, etc. And it's just another barrier to getting research done. Cow blood doesn't work. Human serum has to be used. It's difficult. What about the genome? It's yeast size. It's on the order of yeast size. We're talking only about 6,000 to 7,000 genes.
Is it a eukaryote?
It's a primitive eukaryote. It's a plasmodia. Primitive, but well-tuned to its job, I should say. There are about 14 chromosomes. There are 6,000 to 7,000 genes. The final number, we'll see what it comes out to be. There are three sequencing centers on this project, Tiger, Sanger, and Stanford. The sequencing project's been going on for quite a number of years now, and it won't be done for another 2 years. So unlike these other high-profile organisms, which get done very rapidly, like the human genome, this guy is really taking its time. And that may be because of the technical complexities of sequencing this high AT content DNA as well. So there's additional reasons why it's taking so long, but it is. If you look in the database today, there are only two chromosomes that have been finished, comprising 550 open reading frames, chromosomes 2 and 3. And you can freely download those and look at those. Preliminary sequence information from the other chromosomes is also available on the websites, but it's unannotated, unassembled, not really put together. So how do we attack a genome like this? Well, I started studying malaria several years ago. There was very little sequence information available and very little annotation available. So what we decided to do is something a little different. We made a random genomic array. What does that mean? What we did is we chopped up the DNA randomly, cloned it into bacteria, and then picked colonies and printed random genomic clones from malaria. So I don't know what gene is on every spot. In fact, there may not be any gene on a spot, in the spot. But it's one DNA fragment per spot. And I'm banking on hitting genes. So I size-selected them to be around 1, 2 kb, etc. This library was made by Caslow, NIH. And then we took the clones and spotted them. So this is a way with which you have no sequence information, you can bootstrap your way into a genome for which is almost nothing known about it.
So 10,000
spots. That's all. Each spot, yeah, in there, in that range, they vary. And so the idea is you can do some experiments, isolate RNA, and when you get hits, you can then sequence them. So it's sort of like do experiments, sequence later, instead of sequence first, then do experiments. And so this strategy works quite well, especially for genomes which don't have a lot of tension in the sequencing centers. And you can do exactly the same thing. So this is only like, I think, 80 or so experiments going down, and this is 10,000 clones going across here. And we have very, very few of these sequenced. And we don't have these very well characterized. And these are a bunch of malaria-specific genes of interest to malaria community. But, you know, like yeast, you see clustering of genes for which you do have sequence on, like the ribosome, etc. The same sort of transcriptional generalities that came out of yeast apply to this organism as well and apply to every other organism we've ever looked at. And so that's a good thing, because we can use that sort of information to get at some what these genes actually do. Now, the bummer part of this is that it's expensive to sequence clones. And I'm not Celera. And so going through and exhaustively sequencing this is difficult. And there's some diminishing returns with that, too, because this is not guaranteed to be a unique copies of each fragment. There could be duplicates again and again and again in there. Now, hopefully, we pull them out by the fact that they cluster together and know not to sequence those. But how do you know when to stop? These are issues that we deal with. But what we really like is a gene-specific array. And the sequencing centers have released a lot of raw sequence information, probably covering around 95% of the genome. That's a good thing. We can use that information now. So we're effectively going to abandon the random genomic array. Although we've proved its utility, we want to move into something we can really do. So this is how we designed the array. There's three sequencing centers, Tiger, Sanger, and Stanford. They released their raw sequence reads. Some of it's a little assembled, some of it's not assembled, it's varying condition. We download all that stuff, it's unannotated. Tiger has very graciously released their gene finding algorithm called GlimmerM, because it's been trained on malaria. And there's a paper on this. I should have put the reference on this slide, but it's an implicit Markov model gene finding algorithm, and it used its training set every known malaria gene they could get their hands on. And so it does a pretty good job detecting genes. Now there's other gene finding algorithms that do better jobs than on different organisms or find alternative genes than GlimmerM. We chose to go with this initially, and we set the parameters to overpredict. That is, if you overpredict, if you predict a gene that's not really a gene, there's really no penalty for that other than wasted space on your chip. And we've got real estate, so that's not an issue. So the goal is to overpredict and just make an element for everything we find. The ORF predictions split off two ways. We predict the ORFs. Jing's a graduate student in my lab, and Marcin is a graduate student in Fred Cohen's lab. And basically, Marcin's job is going to try to draw some annotation of these raw sequencing reads, because there's no annotation from the sequencing centers. And Jing's job is to design optimal oligos for the array. And so what does that mean? When I mean optimal oligos, I mean finding the most unique region of the gene with respect to all the genomic sequence, the most 3' end biased, because we're priming from that end, the one with the least secondary structure, that is looking for palindromes, things that can fold up, make hairpins, etc., and balanced ATGC content, that is balanced to some preset, like 75% AT or whatnot, that is the melting temperature should be roughly equal across the array, and also masking repeats, because they're homopolymeric repeats in the genome we'd like to avoid. Okay. Yep. Oh, I'll give you many. I was going to get to some of those, actually. But typical experiments are many of the same experiments we do in yeast. A lot of perturbation analysis, although they have a different goal. So for example, I'd like to know how a drug-resistant strain of malaria responds to treatment with a given compound compared to one that's sensitive. A reasonable question to ask. Again, we had Operon actually synthesize the 7-mers, although we designed them all. And we also have synthesis capabilities now as well. And then we just print them. Marcin is using the Kestrel board from UC Santa Cruz, which does the Smith-Waterman searching algorithm on chip, so it's very, very fast, and is doing Smith-Waterman searches of the NR, the non-redundant database, for any hits at all. That is to get some sort of, some sort of annotation linked to any one of these sequences. Because it's useless without actually knowing what these genes actually are, what they do, or what they could be doing. These things get printed, and then we have a database system in the lab called NOMAD, which we're going to release to the public pretty soon. It's just a structure for holding all the experiments and all the annotations and all the stuff associated with it. As you develop more and more data, the lab really requires a system to enforce annotation and store results, warehouse results, and be able to get them out. And there are a lot of companies making these big Oracle-based databases to do just this, but they're charging a lot of money for those things. And so we have our own that we just wrote in-house, because I don't have $1 million-a-year license ability. And this is what it looks like. So this is the malaria array done with long 7-mers printed on glass. And what we're actually comparing in this experiment is an early stage of the malaria parasite. This is the malaria parasite inside the red blood cell. And this is a late stage of the parasite after it's replicated and divided many times inside the red blood cell. And so this is called the ring stage because it looks like a ring. These are called schizonts or schizonts, depending on who you ask. And these guys are going to burst out of the red blood cell and then reinvade neighboring erythrocytes. So this process of growing from one invader into many is what we'd like to take a look at. And this is just a snapshot. So in one typical experiment, we're going to be doing time courses of this process, which is about 48 hours, to look at all genes, when they're transcribed, and with which specificity to which stage. And that's important. Because if you want to come up with a drug target, it better be expressed at the right time. That if it's expressed in the mosquito, and you're treating someone who's got it in their body, that in the blood stage, that drug is going to have zero effect. So this is sort of the preliminary analysis we need. We need to know what genes are active and when. And as you can see, we get much the same sort of patterns that you see on all these other chips. And so now we're embarking on a whole series of experiments, like the ones I mentioned. But we have to do the preliminary experiments, the basic perturbations. What happens when there's a temperature shift, cold and hot? That happens in the lab, accidentally sometimes. We need to know about it, so if it happens, we can catch it. What happens when pH changes? What happens when metabolic intermediates or nutrients run low? All very crucial questions that we have to characterize. So essentially, we're building a database up of hundreds of these expression experiments as the fundamental foundation with which to do other experiments in malaria and to target genes for disruption and further analysis. This is what it really looks like. So most people grow malaria in tiny little culture dishes, 50 mil, 25 mil, sometimes 100 mil, you're going big style. But we need to get a lot of RNA to do our experiments for our gene chip analysis and for what we're doing. And so we've adapted commercial bioreactor technology. This is a 5-liter bioreactor traditionally meant for yeast. And we're filling it full of human blood. And so this is human blood. We usually fill it up with about 5 liters of blood and let it churn away. And we can perfuse gas through it, and we can dump nutrients into it on demand and take out samples. And that way, things aren't in separate flasks being taken in and out of culture hoods and being perturbed in unnatural ways. It's one constant environment at all times. Temperature controlled, pH controlled, gas controlled, etc. So we're trying to control those external variables which we know could have drastic effects on gene expression if we're not careful. That's sort of the way some of these things are done. And it's kind of hard, arduous work. And you know, the postdocs can only give blood every 8 weeks is the legal limit. So we're sort of limited by the number of postdocs we have in the lab. But I'm bent on attracting more. Now, there are some who may go over the limit. What other kind of experiments can we do? So I mentioned the blood stage cell cycle, very important. Temperature shifts, pH, serum fractions. What is it about human serum that malaria needs to survive? There's components in there, probably lipids, that have been not identified. Perhaps we can identify them. Nutrient starvation. We'd like to perturb and probe metabolic pathways in malaria, looking for genes that are essential, that have no counterpart in the human genome. That's a good drug target. Oxidative stress. We know they're sensitive to oxidative stress. What is it about oxidative stress that's important? What are the genes that respond to it? Drug treatments, for the obvious reason. There are strains of malaria that have accelerated resistance to drugs. Pradeep Rathod at CUA is studying these. He's actually at Seattle now. And genetic mapping. I mentioned there's this cross that was done. Well, they collected the progeny from that cross, all 48, and there's been some genetic mapping been done on those. We can examine the progeny of that cross. They've been propagated. We'd like to look at global strain variation. What is it about Southeast Asian strains that make them so nasty? Sexual differentiation, a critical process in malaria because it's the sexual form of the parasite that's actually taken up by the mosquito and transmitted. And then one hybrid stuff, which is more yeastology. And that's where I think I'm going to stop. My throat's getting sore. But Holly Bennett's a technician in my lab. She helped tremendously. Jing designed the oligos. ZB was the guy pipetting into the fermenter there and is the postdoc that's headed up our malaria project and done essentially all the work on that with Holly. Jennifer Gerton's work I spoke at length about, the SPO11 cohesins. And then Brian Pulliam is our SQL guru wizard. And I have two other postdocs in the lab whose work I did not talk about. Thank you very much.
They all have to give blood even though they're not working on malaria?
Yes. Yeah, you come to my lab, you weigh over 110, you give blood.